Well, it's also not, well, yes. Yeah. Well, it's something in 2 plus 1 dimension. That's all that. So I thank the organizers for inviting me. And I know we're only halfway through the conference, so half of you haven't given your talks yet. And it's very hard to listen to people when you know you have to go soon in the next couple of days. So I'm going to try and be sort of schematic just to give you an idea of the ingredients that go into this area of string theory to see why it's interesting. And it shouldn't be too difficult because most of the reasons it's interesting is because of the phenomena in 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theories. Not to say the string theory that makes it interesting, but the phenomena we are trying to describe. And my job is made a lot easier because of Yuji's great introduction to ADS-CFT. But so I'm going to start out in an orthogonal, describe great gravity duality, but sort of in an orthogonal direction, because you can emphasize different aspects of it, and different aspects will be important for me here. So I'm going to start with a slightly different take on the history and different emphasis on certain aspects. So probably the first idea of trying to think of string theory as a dual description of gauge theory was the Hooks back in 1974. And it's a very simple idea, which is simply you look at Feynman diagrams of quarks interacting through gluon exchange. So you draw the Feynman diagrams, they look sort of like this. And he suggested maybe you can take some limit by tuning the parameters of your theory in which these diagrams become very dense. And he suggested maybe it would look like a two-dimensional surface, these Feynman diagrams. And then the jump from that was that, well, strings, when they move through space-time, they sweep out two-dimensional surfaces. And that was the birth of the idea of string theory as a dual description, just that these strings would sort of describe these Feynman diagrams. So that was 1974. And then in 1981 and the early 80s, when Politico was studying his formulation of string theory, he realized that if you take string theory, the reason people talk about super string theory in 10 dimensions is that if you take string theory, it's not that people started with 10 dimensions, they wanted to do it in 4 dimensions at first, believe it or not. But when you take string theory in, say, 4 dimensions or anything that's not 10 or 26, it turns out the string theory generates an extra dimension in a certain formalism. That is, you think you've written down string theory with a certain number of space-time dimensions, but there's really an extra hidden dimension. So when Politico set up his formulation, he realized that if you just take Tulip's idea, let me go back. If you take Tulip's idea of trying to describe quantum field theory in 4 dimensions, you think these strings are propagating in 4 dimensions, but you work it out in the correct formalism that you suggested, and it generates an extra dimension for the strings. So the field theory is still at the boundary in, say, d dimensions, which is 4. In this talk, I'm actually going to go to 3 dimensions, but usually you would want to 4. It generates an extra dimension. It's called the Liouville dimension, but the important thing he realized was that this extra dimension wasn't an extra flat dimension. It's not like you're going to have 5-dimensional flat string theory, but you're going to have a 5-dimensional space-time with some sort of warp factor up front. So Z is extra dimension. X mu are the dimensions we live in or where the gauge theory lives. And so based on this, he refined this into a very definite conjecture. In around 96, this was just before the more famous ADS-CFT correspondence. And just based on, so far I've not used B-brain, supersymmetry, none of that. This is far more general than that. And his conjecture was that gauge theory in D dimensions would be described by string theory in D plus 1 warp dimensions. And you quantify it with some unknown warp factor. And different warp factors were expected to describe. I think the lights are better off, right? So he suggested that you have this sort of duality between string theory in D dimensions and string theory in D plus 1 warp dimensions in gauge theory. But he couldn't give a definite example, but this was sort of a general proposal he put forward. So that's gauge gravity duality in its generality. But the big breakthrough was when somebody could come up with a very specific example, an instance of this, And that's where you need to bring in deep brains and supersymmetry. But I want to sort of show you that these are two independent ideas. Deep brains and supersymmetry help you realize a concrete example because supersymmetry makes things very simple. So you know, when you want to come up with a concrete example, it may help you. But anyway, that breakthrough was when Malvasena and then later Gubser, Klebanow, Polyakov, and Witten came up with this example using D-brains, where the unknown warp factor was taken to be 1 over z squared. Yudi went over the derivation, the arguments they came up with D-brains, but I'm going to talk about it in this language. So it's basically Polyakov's form of the metric, but with this warp factor. What's special about this warp factor? First of all, it creates the space-time called ADS that Yudi was talking about, which has a boundary, a lower dimensional boundary. And this specific A factor has this dilation symmetry. You can rescale your space-time coordinates, but then you rescale the extra dimension, and the metric remains in value. And what this reflects is that you're going to actually be describing a conformal gauge theory. That is a gauge theory with no intrinsic scale. And that's why it's called ADS-CFT duality, which is sort of a subset of, you know, or an instance of general gauge gravity duality. So conformal field theories are very special points, special fixed gauge theories, and you need supersymmetry because it's much easier to construct a gauge theory in which couplings don't run if you have something artificial like supersymmetry to cancel divergences. So again, I want to say that it's, you know, the idea itself is simple work. Yeah. So in many examples that people have been constructing and that I will talk about, this A of Z starts with the conformal factor 1 over Z squared. But you could possibly add some other higher terms to it. And obviously, when you add a term like this, you're introducing a length scale into the problem. So changing A away from this factor corresponds to having some non-trivial gauge dynamics. And that's important because, you know, when people came up with, when Truth proposed string theory as a dual to gauge theory, he wasn't trying to describe conformal field theory because, I mean, QCD has a conformal regime, but you don't need, you know, it's the easy regime, it's weakly coupled. What you want to describe is non-trivial RG dynamics. You want to describe real-world field theories which have scales and then have the non-trivial flow. Anyway, so that's ADS-CFT. But because we are now doing, so in ADS-CFT, because we're using superstring theory, or in some cases M theory, you need 10 or 11 dimensions. So Polyakov's argument was just, you have a gauge theory in so many dimensions, you just need one extra dimension that the strings propagate in. But since this instance was derived using superstrings, you need to put in an extra 6 or 7 dimensions. And that was the focus of Yudi's last 10 minutes, which these extra dimensions show up as an internal space. And in this context, what this internal space does is it encodes details of the dual field theory, like it, you know, what gauge group it has, how much supersymmetry, how much global symmetry, the matter content, and so on. While the ADS space sort of tells you that it's conformal, or if you modify it a bit, it, you know, introduces RG flow and so on. Anyway, so that's again a quick review of ADS-CFT. So the most popular, so the last 10 years, people have been doing this with ADS-5 times some space, which is what Yudi was talking about, which are string duals to 3+1 dimensional field theory. But this year, finally, this collaboration, Aharoni, Bergman, Jeffries, and Malvasena, could propose a field theory dual to ADS-4, that the dual would be a 2+1 dimensional field theory. And this is more, well, it's interesting because 2+1 dimensional field theories show, you know, a variety of new phenomena like fractional statistics and all condensed matter, many condensed matter systems are in 2+1 dimensions, and many new phenomena arise here which don't show up in 3+1. But when you start, you have to start with the simplest problem. And so they started with the most symmetric and most supersymmetric space, ADS-4 plus S7, and they proposed a field theory dual. So I'm going to describe this, and then I'm going to describe our work on this, which was to deform this into less supersymmetric ones, and also our other work, which is in progress, which is to try and construct non-supersymmetric ADS-CFT. So So people have tried it earlier in 3+1 dimensions, but it turns out string theory doesn't really like lack of supersymmetry, but it might be more favorable in these dimensions. But that's more speculative work I'll get to at the end. So what did Malacena and what did this collaboration propose? It's a gauge theory, but already something interesting happens here. We know it should be a conformal theory. You have a gauge theory. This is the typical kinetic term you could add for gauge fields, but that's a dimension 4 operator. In 2+1 dimensions, that's not a marginal operator. So you can't have a kinetic term for the gauge fields. What you can have instead is a Chern-Simons term for the gauge fields, and that's all they have in this theory. Well, that's the abelian version. You can write a non-abelian version. And then they have some matter fields, Zs and Ws. So these are 4 complex fields. And the way to think of them is 4 complex fields describe an 8 real dimensional space. And this S7 is sort of the natural sphere that lives in this 8 dimensional space. Some details, they have a superpotential like this. And this year there have been like 150 papers, you know, doing mostly, since, you know, we spent the last 10 years doing this for ADS5. Once somebody proposes an ADS4 field theory, it's easy to recycle some of those papers, and many of them have come out already in this in the course of this year. But there are some new problems here in this theory that don't come up in the 3+1 dimensional case. So I was saying these Z fields describe an 8 dimensional real space where this S7 is. So S7 is completely symmetric. It's SO8 symmetric, right? So you would expect these Z and Ws to be rotated into each other under symmetry. But their gauge indices are different. You see, this is n bar n, and this is n n bar. And that's where things get interesting. So this theory is expected to have maximal supersymmetry. Don't worry about what these numbers mean. Just think of this as the maximal supersymmetry you can have in 2+1 dimensions. But the theory this collaboration wrote down has only lesser symmetry manifest, supersymmetry manifest. And the reason is because these gauge fields, these matter fields, which should be transformed into each other, have somewhat different gauge structure. And this is still not completely proven and or established. But the reason they think this can work out is because in 2+1 dimensions, you're allowed these extra operators, which in some sense can transmute these gauge indices. So I'm going to describe it in a way that's intuitive, but it's not technically correct. But it's still, it captures the essence of it, in at least the abelian case, which is you think of these operators, you think of a Wilson line. A Wilson loop is gauge invariant object, but a Wilson line transforms under gauge transformations at the endpoints of your of the line, right? So you take a Wilson line that runs from some finite space-time point off to infinity. And this thing, you know, the gauge transformations here don't matter. It's at infinity. So this object would transform like a field, like a non-gauge invariant operator inserted at the point x. And you could choose A to be in any representation of the gauge group you want, in which case this would transform at x in some representation of the gauge group. The good thing that happens in this dimension is that this, you can show in certain circumstances that this operator doesn't really depend on the details of this path. So it's actually a local operator which transforms non-trivially under the gauge group. So in particular, you could take it to be in this representation, say. What you could do then is take, say, this W, which is, say, in the NN bar representation, multiply it with a Wilson loop. It's actually going to be, the correct description of this is as a magnetic operator, an operator that's sort of the creation operator for magnetic monopoles. This is sort of, this is just easier for me to communicate in short time, but it's really a magnetic, it's a creation operator for magnetic monopoles. And when you take a product of these, you could get a representation which looks like the Z's. And then you have hope that this object could transform with the Z's and form a full SO8 symmetric thing. So this is an interesting new phenomena because usually when you have electric and magnetic variables, they're dual variables. You use one or the other. But it looks like in this theory, these two electric, let's say, let's call the Z if it's electric one, then this combination is going to be magnetic. The electric and magnetic variables occur together within a supermultiply. So supersymmetry takes you from electric to magnetic variables, and that's something new that I don't think has been seen in other theories before. Well, just for this talk, I'm going to call it Z3 and Z4 to make the symmetry manifest. So now I have four complex fields, Z1 through Z4, which will be natural. Anyway, so that's the simplest theory, and that's the reason that collaboration brought out the paper, which provided the impetus for, I don't know, 150 papers this year. So any questions before I move on to work? So where we started was, the space ADS4 plus S7 is known to be a solution of, to be one solution of a more complicated theory called gauge supergravity in four dimensions. And I don't want to get into the details. I don't even know the details of this theory. It was studied in the 80s. It's long since. It was studied in the 80s because people thought this was going to be the universe we live in, because it has four non-compact directions. But the point is, it's some theory with some effective potential. And the simple solution is sort of the vacuum you get at the origin, the simplest of solutions. But it has a rich structure in that there are five other extrema of this action, five other non-trivial extrema. And Warner in 83, this is a cutout from his paper, characterized the five minima you have. Most of them have no supersymmetry. This one has supersymmetry. And actually, this one actually has supersymmetry. It's a mistake in his paper. It was later realized. But the question we asked ourselves was, what about this last vacuum, this supersymmetric one? It's minimally supersymmetric. It's a lot less supersymmetric than the previous one. What is there a gauge dual for this? So if you're outside the field, you may ask yourself, well, why wouldn't you try to do one of the non-supersymmetric ones? But we search under the lamppost, and it's much easier to do the supersymmetric one. So that's where we start. So the question we asked ourselves was, how do you get this far less symmetric theory, which is a solution of the same gauge supergravity theory? So I only want to give a flavor. The details may not be interesting. So I only want to talk about those parts which sort of bring out general principles of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And the idea was, well, first you have this conformal Lagrangian that collaboration had written down, which describes ADS4 times S7. And then you add a mass term to one of the fields. So when you add a mass term, you know, you've introduced a scale into the problem. You don't expect your field theory to be conformal anymore. And that is what you'd expect is that this ADS space gets deformed in the infrared. So in the far ultraviolet, this Lagrangian still looks like the conformal Lagrangian because you don't see a mass term when you're at very high energies. So you'd expect this part of ADS space to sort of be undisturbed. But when you go to the infrared physics, you expect some deviation. And in general, you'd expect it to deform the internal space as well. So our conjecture was to try and add such a term because it breaks the symmetries in the right way as well. And well, this operator, you know, even if you didn't know anything about monopole operators earlier, if you just start studying this theory for a few minutes, you realize, you know, obvious gauge invariant operators that you think the theory has, you can't actually write down given the matter content unless you add these Wilson loops or these monopole operators in here. But that's how you form some of these operators. So this is the most technical slide I have. Don't have to follow most of the equations. It's a very simple field theory calculation. All you do is you've added a mass term for a field. You integrate out the field, find out what you're left with in the far infrared. And you just need to look at the last equation, which gives you the potential you get when you integrate out. And turns out it's SU3 symmetric. And you can, from this, you can read off the dimension of each of the fields. And the number you get is 1/3. So this is the main prediction we have from the field theory side. We added an operator. We conjecture we have a new conformal interacting conformal field theory. with some amount of global symmetry in certain dimensions. Now, why do we think this is correct, or what evidence do we have for this? Well, again, as is often the case in string theory, people work things out. They sort of find the answers before they find questions. Well, that's what they say. That's the justification for working on some of these things, because they don't seem to answer any obvious question. But people along, like about 10 years ago, worked out some complicated supergravity solutions which looked qualitatively like this. It had two ADS throats. The two extremes, it looks, the warp factor is 1 over z squared. And in between, there are some deviations away from conformality. And if you look at one end of it, it looks like the simple space-time ADS 4 plus S7. It's dual to the theory I described a couple of slides ago. It's maximally symmetric, and you'd expect this end to be dual to the field theory I described. You come to the other end, and you find it's not, you don't have S7, but some sort of squashed S7. It's a very specific metric called, and they called it the stretched and squashed S7. And they worked out the amount of supersymmetry and the amount of symmetry, and it's exactly what we found from the field theory side as well. The same amount of symmetry and the same amount of supersymmetry. But this infrared is more interesting than just, you know, another example of ADS-CFT. And that's because the typical examples of ADS-CFT are you take an ADS-4 space or ADS whatever space multiplied by some Einstein space, and you get a duality. But this example is more interesting because the ADS metric actually is warped by a function in front of the X7 metric. So it's not quite a direct product, but it's a warped product. Why is that interesting? Well, this is the technical point, probably not interesting. It's interesting because, so you might have heard that, you know, in field theories, there's this theorem that when you go from the ultraviolet to infrared, the central charge of the theory has to decrease. The number of degrees of freedom has to decrease. In the ADS-CFT language, it means that the volume of this internal space has to increase. But we started with S7. So doing this is sort of like asking, you know, I fix a radius for you, or I fix some sort of scale for you, and ask you, what's the largest volume object you can form of a certain size? And the answer is obviously a sphere, right? I mean, with a given radius, the sphere is the largest object. So you think you shouldn't have any RG flow starting from a sphere. But it turns out that this, because of this warping, this quiet sphere actually has effectively larger volume. And then I think it's, in fact, the only known such compactification, which has larger volume than the seven sphere itself. So in some string theoretic sense, you have an object with even larger volume. So, yeah.
Why is it a conformal scale frame?
It's not. So it's, so that was, yes. So we add, a mass term. So you start off here. It's conformal. You add a mass term, so you start flowing. And then you reach the infrared, and our conjecture was you have another interacting conformal field theory there, and this gravity solution bears that out. So the interesting thing here is this is not quite ADS-CFT duality. It's sort of gauge gravity duality, because you have a gravity dual to an entire RG flow. So you have a mass term and it flows. There are scales, and there's one scale in the problem. So there's a duality between. Okay, so that was one of the projects. So again, I guess this slide might. So just to summarize, you have this sort of solution where this S7 gets deformed into a squashed and stretched S7 with less supersymmetry, less symmetry, and the entire background is dual to that. So so far I just showed you how the symmetries match up. You can do some more computations to verify somewhat more non-trivial predictions, but it's a bit technical, and maybe I won't go into the details. But I still made the slide, so I'll show you the nice animations I had. But So usually the way you check such a gauge gravity duality is you compute some dimensions of operators in your field theory. Like I was saying, there's a number 1/3 for one of the fields. And then you have to take the gravity theory and sort of consider spherical harmonics on the internal space. Like, you know, you have YLM on a two-sphere, the spherical harmonics. You can generalize that on these higher spaces and compare sort of the spectrum between these two. That's a very difficult problem for this Quest S7. These slides were about, you know, a technical simplification we could do in which this group theory took us further than we expected. And I'll only do the summary. So usually you'd be able to compare only things protected by supersymmetry. That's a constant feature of ADS-CFT duality. You compare mostly things completely protected by supersymmetry. But we could go a little further where we could find the structure of what are called long multiplets, and it matched up on the two sides. But unless you're in the field, you know, or even if you're in the field, you'll start yawning if I talk for more than a minute.
Information is by monopole mass operator.
No, it's an operator for one of the matter fields. All I meant was that so a mass term is simply. So, I mean, this is what you think of as a mass term. In n equals 4 or something, you could write, but a mass term has to be gauge invariant, so you'd write trace p squared. If a field was an adjoint representation, you could take the trace. But now the fields are bifundamentals. That is, they have alpha, beta, what do you call it? Let's say beta dot. So it has two different kinds of indices. So when you square such an object, there's no way to make it gauge invariant. Unless you add in these Wilson lines or monopole operators, which can soak up the indices. But it's a mass term for the complex field. It's just, and this is the problem, not just in our theory, not a problem, but this is a feature of AB, of this highly supersymmetric theory as well. Just exactly. Yes. Two. Yes. Yes, this part I didn't get into. So the non-trivial thing about these monopole operators, which we haven't been able to verify, but we definitely need that property, and ABJM needs that property, is that these operators don't change the physical dimension of another operator when you add it in. These monopole operators are of zero dimension. It wouldn't be too shocking because so when Tooft originally studied monopole operators, he found some scaling dimension, but those theories had a kinetic term. So this theories only have a Chern-Simons term, and it's plausible that monopole operators in this theory have no physical dimension.
Anomalous dimensions.
Right, the other fields do have
these.
So the way to do this is this explicit construction of these monopoles. I think Kapustin has done this in some cases in 3+1 dimensions. But Berenstein told us that, I don't really understand his paper, but he works with these sort of dimensionally reduced models of these field theories, and he says he can see somehow that the fact that Chern-Simons is first order leads to the fact that these operators have no dimension. I mean, I think it's definitely still out in the dark for us. So that was a spiel about a slightly less supersymmetric theory. Now I'm getting into some more speculative area, which is work still in progress. But we have some ideas that we could present. And the idea is, why don't we start doing ADS-CFT without supersymmetry? So if you remember the original idea, these internal spaces decide how much supersymmetry you have, right? So if you take S7, you have maximal supersymmetry. And over the last 10 years, I don't know, the 4,000 papers that have been written in this area basically replace that internal space with one new but less supersymmetric space. And you could ask, why don't we just replace it with a completely non-supersymmetric space, that is ADS4 cross some H7, which is not supersymmetric. And the problem is, once in string, at least through string theory, once you become non-supersymmetric, you run into all sorts of instabilities. And I wanted to illustrate some of that and explain why things could be much better in ADS4. And the way to think about it is this. Let's say you have something that you think is a conformal fixed point, right? So around the conformal fixed point, you have three kinds of operators: relevant, marginal, irrelevant. So in three dimensions, these are dimension 3 operators. these have dimension less than 3, these have dimension greater than 3. But if you have a conformal fixed point, the beta functions for all of them must vanish for a certain value of their coupling constant, right? No, but what happens, the problem with non-supersymmetric theories is there are some smaller corrections to their beta functions that are impossible to compute. So let's consider some arbitrary corrections to these beta functions. So for some reason, you think you have a conformal theory in some limit. Let's say n is infinity. It's going to turn out to be 1 over n corrections. You have a conformal theory in some limit, non-supersymmetric. But you worry that if you make n large but finite, as long as it's not infinity, you're going to get some corrections to your beta function. So consider adding these corrections, some unknown corrections that we can't compute in the foreseeable future. Let's add this to these fixed points. The important thing is to have a 0 of the beta function, right? So when you add this, what happens to these three graphs? So the relevant and irrelevant ones, the conformal fixed point can at most move by some amount. So when you would have had a conformal fixed point at some other value of the coupling, but now it moves by a small amount because you've added a small correction. The same for the irrelevant one. But the marginal one could conceivably be completely destroyed. There may be no 0 once you've added the correction. And that's the problem. So that suggests a natural way out in that this is actually an argument of Cyber, Gray, and Berkus many years ago, 10 years ago, that you should maybe try to think of non-supersymmetric gauge theories, which have, in the infinite end limit, no marginal operators whatsoever. And if that were the case, then you could say, when you put in 1 over n corrections, you still expect a fixed point somewhere nearby. Okay. The problem in 3 plus 1 dimensions, which is where people tried this earlier, is that the gauge coupling is always marginal. So if you take ADS5 plus S5, this in the gravity language, it means that the dilaton is massless. But I want to talk in gauge theory language. And trace F squared, the kinetic term, is always a marginal operator. So you'll never be able to rule out such a problem unless you can do very complicated, explicit 1 over n corrections. But the situation is much better in ADS4 plus S7 because, first of all, there are no, the kinetic term is not marginal. And it turns out there is no such problematic operator. But the argument we have is sort of a very general one. And I want to present it in this form. Think of a family of internal spaces, that is a family of conformal field theories parameterized by some n. N could be discrete, continuous, it doesn't matter. And let's say one of them is supersymmetric. The argument is very simple. It's just that the dimension of any operator is the continuous function of this n. And so if you imagine plotting the dimension of that operator against n, the only operators we need to be worried about are those which had dimensions close to 3 or something. So let's say there was an operator that was exactly marginal in the supersymmetric case at n equals 0. The point is, as soon as you move away from n equals 0, you must have one of these three possibilities. The black and the orange one are sort of the generic ones where they lift off. And then the one problematic possibility is the straight line. So if you had any of these, you're safe. You have a marginal operator at a supersymmetric point where it doesn't create problems. Once you move away, just from the fact that it's a continuous function means it's going to be away from marginality. So you don't have a problem. The only thing you need to rule out is that there are the possibility of operators that are marginal at the supersymmetric point and stay marginal even when you're not supersymmetric. And we could easily verify that there's only one candidate really for such an operator. I won't get into the details, but we could compute it. And it's not like the blue line. It's more like the black line or the orange line. So anytime you have a family of non-supersymmetric spaces, you don't really even need to do calculations. If you have a family of non-supersymmetric spaces with one member that's supersymmetric, then you guarantee that at least close to this point, you have non-supersymmetric theories which are perturbatively stable. So that sounds like good news, but So I guess I have, if n is an integer, yeah, this argument may not be good. But what I had in mind was usually when you have such a family, n is a rational number, maybe. Uh-huh. And when n is a rational number, you know, there, it, I mean, it accumulates. Yeah, it's, I mean, and we have an, we did this in an explicit calculation, like, we took these spaces called MPQs, P by Q is some rational number, and it characterizes it, and so you have spaces closer and closer to the zero point, and it's just some polynomial function in that parameter. It accumulates near zero, so, yeah, if it's an integer, it may be a problem. So, and that was, so I just wanted to focus on the fact that we could rule out perturbative instabilities of non-supersymmetric theories in ADS-4, which doesn't work in ADS-5. But recently we've been investigating another problem, which is that it's an old problem that Witten pointed out, which is when you have non-supersymmetric spaces, this has nothing to do with, don't think it has anything to do with string theory, but just non-supersymmetric gravitational spaces. It turns out that there is a tunneling instability. If you have a space-time with one compact direction, let's say a circle, like Witten originally just studied R9 plus S1, then essentially using an Einstein black hole solution, you can construct a tunneling solution in which a bubble of nothing appears. So it's sort of like a phase transition where, you know, you form a bubble and it condenses into a new vacuum, except that this bubble is a bubble of nothing because, so let's say you have some R9 times S1. So there's a circle at every point in your, it doesn't have to be R9, it could be, yeah, it could be any R, it doesn't matter, it could work. So there's a circle at every point. What he showed was there's a tunneling solution in which the circle sort of degenerates to zero size at some point in your space. So sort of a hole opens up because the circle is, and it's a completely non-singular solution. It's similar to one slide that Yuji had about thermal theories, but it basically forms a cigar-shaped geometry like this. So in a way, it's a phase transition, but the new vacuum has no space-time at all, and this bubble expands out and wipes out the entire space-time. So we looked at this. So Polchinski had studied the same instability in ADS-5, and it turns out it affects ADS-4 as well. Polchinski, Horowitz, and a student of theirs, Ortega. So we looked at the same instability in ADS-4, and the news is it's sort of mixed. Generically, it looks like most non-supersymmetric spaces are wiped out by this, but it looks like there are some exceptions which are also perturbatively stable, so it looks like there might be isolated vacua. The reason we aren't more certain of this is because the way to study this instability is numerical. And so we can definitely say when something is unstable, but when I say something is stable, it's not, we can't really prove it for sure. But the take-home message is that non-supersymmetric spaces are generically non-perturbatively unstable, but there could be discrete isolated cases in string theory which are, which might provide an ADS-CFT dictionary without any supersymmetry. So.
The space is compact, right?
It requires, yeah, well,
for the ADS part, it must be, so you must mod it.
No, 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 it happens because of this compactness. So if it was just ADS-4, it's stable, it's fine. It's ADS-4 plus a compact space. Well, it can't be any compact space, but it has to be a compact space with the fundamental group. It has to have a circle that can shrink.
Okay,
it's an integral.
So that's an instability.
Yeah,
because there are another instabilities. It could be if you mod up ADS-4 by some.
Is this the one that Horowitz?
Well, there was some. We can talk.
Okay. Yeah.
So what's the intuitive understanding of the discrete stable points?
This one. Oh. Well, it's. But when I say discrete, I mean it's like, you know, you have this landscape of ADS-4 vacuum. You have many of these compactifications, infinite number of them, and just. When you have non-supersymmetry, when there's no supersymmetry, most of them are unstable due to tunneling. I mean, it's so. In some sense, the philosophy is that if non-supersymmetric stable ones exist, it's like a coincidence. It's not a genetic thing. It's most are ruled out by tunneling instability, and you know, the perturbative stability, on the other hand, counterintuitively seems pretty common from this argument. But it, and we have, like, in one family, we found one, but again, you know, if it's a numerical study, we don't, I mean, we don't trust numerics. So.
I guess I am not quite. So wouldn't you, if you have a relevant operator, right, somehow wouldn't that
be a problem?
Right.
That's sort of a choice that we make in all field theories, that relevant operators can be fine-tuned to zero. But marginal operators, you know, so if you had a case where the beta function was like this, you can't argue for fine-tuning. So here you could put it here.
That's okay. So you're talking about stability in non-supersymmetric models, assuming infinite fine-tuning.
But that's the case even for the 20-fold, or for even all supersymmetric theories, that all the examples we know always have relevant operators. In fact, I don't know if we know any conformal fixed point with no relevant operator. I know, some people have been looking for them, but all this is a more, I think.
Yeah, but in some sense, in those cases, it was a supersymmetry that provided that fine tuning.
Why?
But I agree with you. So in those cases, there is also those operators.
Yeah, I don't think supersymmetry helps you, because even if you're supersymmetric and you have a relevant operator, like a mass term.
So
this would be an instability, but we sort of, it's a general philosophy of quantum field theory, I would say. But a marginal operator which lifts up like this, you have no choice. There's nothing you can do. There's no fine tuning. It's just not conformal. So. Anyway, I think that brings me to the end. I had one final slide with the obligatory future directions, but one category is about highly supersymmetric theory and how you prove supersymmetry there. And then there are more practical ones, like people have been doing transport phenomena from the gravitational side. Now we have a field theory duo to try to compute something. And there's been this trend towards using ADS4 the gravitational theories for marking up various condensed matter phenomena, and maybe you can use the field theory duals for some of these. But I think I'll stop here.
Okay, hold on. Let's start. Arvind again.